Syria is calling for some serious action by the UN Security Council to put an end to Israel's illegal practices in the occupied Golan Heights. Iranian Air Force holds major nationwide drills, and that a week after holding a massive air defense exercise. Polish Prime Minister says his country will not bow to the EU's blackmail over his country's decision to reject parts of the bloc's laws. This is World News from Tehran. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The top story this hour is Syria believes pressure is needed to make Israel stop its violations and illegal constructions in the occupied Golan Heights. The country wants to see some action by the UN Security Council. Syria's UN envoy says that Israeli efforts to change demographics of the Golan Heights or impose its custody there will fail. Bassam Sabah noted that such measures have no legal effect under the relevant UN resolutions. He says that sooner or later, the occupied territory will return to Syria. Sabah also condemned Israel for the assassination of a former Syrian lawmaker last week. The Golan Heights belong to Syria, and all Israeli settlements there are illegal. Israeli officials, however, say that they're planning to eventually increase the settler population there fourfold. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, tells us more about the Israeli violations in the Golan Heights and the specific concerns that Syria is asking the UN to help resolve.
He also strongly condemned the recent statements by the Israeli Prime Minister on increasing the number of settlement units and building 7,000 settlement units over there in the occupied Syrian Golan with the aim of increasing the number of Israeli settlers from 40 to 100,000. He also renewed his call again on the United Nations Security Council to exert pressure on Israel to stop its violations and illegal actions, namely, and he said, that includes the crimes, the Israeli crimes of killing, arrests, looting of private property, and depriving the people of the Golan from their natural resources, and blocking those who left the occupied Syrian Golan for studying or for work or for any reason from returning back. He also said in his statement before the UN Security Council there in session on the Middle East, he said that it is unacceptable anymore. It is unacceptable to see the failure of the United Nations and the international community on forcing Israel to implement the UN relevant resolutions and stop Israel from its violations of human rights and international law. And stopping Israel from doing so, according to Sabah, can never be achieved without removing what he described as the umbrella of protection provided by the United States and its Western allies.
Yemen's Ansarla movement has hit out of the UN Security Council statement that calls for an end to the fight for the liberation of Mara province from Saudi-backed forces. An Ansarla spokesman accused the 15-member UN body of continuing its support for the Saudi-led coalition. Mohammed Abdesalam says the council is undermining its own resolutions on the Yemen conflict. He promised that the Yemeni army and allied Ansarla forces will continue their fight against aggressors. That after the Security Council adopted a statement calling for de-escalation in Yemen that has been devastated by a war launched by Saudi Arabia in 2015. The text also called for an end to the Yemeni army's battle for Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed forces. The army has made significant gains there over the past months. The Iranian Air Force has launched major maneuvers across the country. The main feature of this military exercise is that all operations in different bases across the nation have been commanded online from the main headquarters here in the capital, Tehran.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Air Force has launched massive maneuvers in different locations across the country, including Isfahan, Bushehr, Bandar Abbas, Dizful, and Tabriz. The main operational phase of the large-scale drills, codenamed Fadaiyan Harim Velayat 10, began on Thursday with the participation of manned aircraft and drones. In the first phase of the military drill, aerial targets were shot at different speed and heights. Targets were hit on the ground under different conditions with the use of homemade upgraded heavy and semi-heavy bombs. During this military drill, different types of laser and radar missiles, as well as types of rockets and bombs made by young Iranian specialists, have been used. This is the first time that all the air bases of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran are jointly taking part in the military maneuvers, all in their own cities, but being commanded and controlled from the main command center in Tehran.
We used to hold military exercises in one particular location, but this military drill is being conducted at different locations across the country, and they're being commanded and controlled from the command center in Tehran. All the developments can be seen online by commanders at the headquarters, and so far all the operations have been carried out successfully.
Tens of different types of fighter jets, bombers, cargo planes, reconnaissance planes, and drones have taken part in the military drill. Moreover, Camon 12 drone has successfully destroyed specific targets using smart bombs. At the same time, Karar drones, which have been equipped with 500-pound bombs and rockets, have been able to precisely hit the planned targets. Meanwhile, the manned aircraft of the Air Force of the Army, with the use of the most modern electronic war techniques, disrupted anti-air defense systems of the enemy, preparing the ground for drones to carry out their operations.
This is the first time that such military drill is being conducted all across the country. The main feature of this maneuver is a concentrated command for non-concentrated operations. All the missiles, rockets, and bombs which are being used in this military drill have been produced by Iranian specialists. We have used precision-guided Qased and Yasin bombs. Moreover, we have used our combat drones like Camon 12, which is able to strike its target from a distance of 10 to 15 kilometers.
This massive maneuver is aimed at using an integrated command and control network and supporting operational and intelligence systems in the integrated network of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In the drill, technology-based and digitalized equipment, weaponry, and systems have been used.
This military exercise shows that the Air Force of the Army is well prepared to protect the country's territorial integrity and has full control over the airspace of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The fate of the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and several world countries is hanging in the balance, with major issues still remaining unresolved after several rounds of negotiations. Given the speculation that a new round of talks might be on the cards for the revival of the deal in Vienna, Tehran is saying it's not backing down from its position and is sticking to its demands.
6 years have passed since Iran and several states, namely the US, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany, put their signatures to a deal under which Tehran agreed to limit some of its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. But in 2018, the situation reached a deadlock when former U.S. President Donald Trump backed out of the deal. Not only that, but he also brought back the sanctions despite Iran's display of full compliance. Tehran waited for 1 year before finally cutting back on some of its commitments under the deal. Later on, with the administration of Joe Biden sweeping into power and the White House's declared willingness to return to the negotiating table, Tehran and the remaining signatories went back to the Austrian capital with an agenda to revive the landmark accord. Initially, some progress was made, but long-running issues remain unresolved to this day. In the meantime, the U.S. continues to keep the sanctions in place as a tool of pressure against Iran. Now, with the possibility of a renewed push for the revival of the deal, Tehran says it will not settle for anything less than results that would safeguard the rights of its people.
Iran is a country of dialogue and negotiation. But a negotiation that guarantees the rights of Iranian people and forces all parties to return to their commitments.
Iran has been second to 1 point, but Washington was the party to violate the deal and should therefore be the party to take the first step by returning to full compliance. Tehran says it will start resuming its commitment only after the complete removal of all U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner. Action and not words. That's what Iran is demanding. It also says the European partners likewise need to put aside their empty promises and get back to action.
It was the inaction of the European states that emboldened Trump to withdraw from all agreements and violate the JCPOA and Resolution 2231. That happened because the European capitals all acted as only passive observers. We are expecting that all sides come to Vienna with the full understanding that there is no shying away from their commitments, which should be fully implemented under the accord.
Iran is seeking reassurances from the European signatories that such violations would never happen again. It says any renegotiation of the terms of the deal is out of question. The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi is reviewing the details of the previous six rounds of discussions held in Vienna. Now, with speculations on the possible resumption of talks in the coming days and Tehran's firm stance, one can only speculate about how the other parties will fare up.
A hospital in Tehran is offering medical treatment to some of the victims of a deadly terrorist attack that happened in neighboring Afghanistan. Just days ago, Iran's deputy ambassador visited the injured at that facility. The official says that following their defeat in Afghanistan, the U.S. and its allies are trying to use Daesh to cause instability. He says the recent increase in bomb attacks serves exactly that purpose. The official believes that regional countries need to redouble their efforts to prevent similar acts of terrorism in the future. At least 60 people were killed and dozens more got injured in three back-to-back explosions that tore through a mosque in Kandahar during Friday prayers. Daesh claimed responsibility. Unity in the face of injustice, terrorism, and chaos, that was the message of a unity conference held in the Pakistani port city of Karachi. The focus was the new developments in the region that are posing some fresh challenges and risks. Mohammed Touri has a report.
Coincided with the birth of Prophet Muhammad, Iran's cultural center in Karachi has hosted a Muslim unity conference titled Unity, Peace and the Need to Avoid Sectarianism.
Speaker in this gathering in the Unity Week stressed upon the dire need of unity among Muslims in the face of further chaos masterminded by the U.S. and other Western powers humiliated and defeated in the region.
Participants recalled the famous British saying of divide and rule, pointing towards the recent bomb attacks in two mosques in the Afghan cities of Kunduz and Kandahar.
In the world, there is only anti-Islam forces, America and West. Hence, the incidents took place in Kandahar and other places in the last 2 weeks. Yeah, these are designed and supported by Americans and Western countries only to give message that they are not happy to see the victory of Islam.
The unity conferences is the need of this society, especially in the society of Pakistan and for the region. As we are witnessed that in Afghanistan in the recent last 2 weeks, more than 300 innocent Afghani people have been martyred in the result of terrorist attack by the ISIS, and those are supported by the U.S. and Israeli regimes.
Speakers highlighted the ongoing Islamophobia in the West, as well as the atrocities of the Israeli regime. They said Tel Aviv is seeking to sow discord among Muslims.
Killing the innocent people. These people, we think they are not the real Muslim people. We have to awaken all the world. We have to awaken all the population that the real Islam is the religion of peace. The real Islam is the religion of the friendship. And the real Islam is the religion of coexistence.
Experts believe Daesh re-emergence in Afghanistan is a U.S. plot aimed at completing its 20-year failed occupation and mission in the country. Mohammed Touri, Karachi.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have held rallies in several cities, including the capital Khartoum, in support of the democratic transition to a civilian-led government. Supporters of the transitional government took to the streets following a call by an alliance of pro-democracy groups. In Khartoum, police reportedly fired tear gas outside parliament to disperse the ralliers. The African nation is in turmoil amid a standoff between the government of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and the military. Rival demonstrators have been camping outside the presidential palace since Saturday. The pro-military groups demand the dissolution of the government, arguing it has failed them politically and economically. Sudan has been ruled by an interim civilian military government since the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. Now crossing over to Europe, tensions between the European Union and Poland continue to escalate. The Polish Prime Minister says that he will not bow to what he calls blackmail of the 27-member bloc. Ahead of an EU leaders' summit in Brussels, Mateusz Morawiecki said that his country will not accept the bloc make decisions on areas of national competences of its member states. Morawiecki added that he would seek solutions to Warsaw's ongoing feuds with the Union. Tensions heightened earlier this month after Poland's top court rejected the supremacy of some of the EU laws, arguing that they're incompatible with the Constitution. That raised fears that it could be a first step toward Poland leaving the bloc. However, the Polish government has denied any plan for such a thing. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes says that the European Union legislators are pressuring the EU Commission to withhold funding for Poland over the rule of law feud.
Well, EU legislators in Belarus are putting the European Commission, the executive arm of the EU, under pressure to try and basically withhold funding for Poland. We're talking about billions of euro from the EU budget and also the 750 billion euro recovery fund, the COVID-19 recovery fund. Now, EU leaders are meeting at the moment beside me here in Brussels in the European Council building, and it's a two-day summit today and tomorrow, Friday. But this issue is overshadowing all the other important issues. But it has to be said that Poland does have support within the European Council. So you have 27 member states. Poland is one of them. But other countries would have sympathy for Poland's position. So, you know, this might be interesting for constitutional lawyers to discuss. You know, does EU law have primacy over a country's constitution and so on? But I think the bigger picture here relates to the divisions within the European Union. And these are fundamental divisions relating to key structures and key laws within the European Union itself. So it's a little bit unlike some of the disputes that we've seen in the past. This is about the EU itself, and that's why it's so important, and that's why it's so interesting to see how it pans out. Of course, the situation with Poland is a big issue, and it's taking a lot of the focus. But really, it's actually just one example of all of these major divisions, and that's the big problem for the European Union.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis, And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, riot gear, and canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Rich was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality in America, and gun violence, and so forth. Lee, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism. And that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. Mm. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who've captured various scenes and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Richard, one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, it, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that, that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. Mm-hmm. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And they just, their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy, in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized. And to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop. to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. So the way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America mm-hmm. about the nature, scale of racism mm-hmm. and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism mm-hmm. as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on in this fight.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial
did see
inequality.
A lot of white people in the crowds in support of the black.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse mm. over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch sticker on there. Got some walkie-talkies. It's two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield no more, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff, and that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. Don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
You saw David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. He's quite an endearing and inspirational mm-hmm. character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And, of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy mm-hmm. yeah. that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. They didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster mm-hmm. post there, where the mainstream media descended on the community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that monitorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's a, there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long
a brief
break
now from the discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
It must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably felt feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about U.S. deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the U.S.?
I think it's largely because of the failure of U.S. Justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017. Those are the numbers you expect in a small war somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like mm-hmm. you were saying, It's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal, yep, 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and,
yeah,
and marginalization, and it's you know, it's that system that's carried on, and
seems that
we're
to her
people
head.
Are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have,
yeah,
Donald Trump,
oh, no,
who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that, yeah, the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world, and it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we much put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: اعلم أنه لا علم كطلب السلامة، ولا سلامة كسلامة القلب.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Know that there is no knowledge like the quest for integrity, and there is no integrity better than the integrity of the heart."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, this beautiful, divinely appointed Imam, full of knowledge and wisdom beyond imagination, has these beautiful conversations with his friends, his companions, his relatives, his family, and the people. We find in one of these conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies to a question regarding the best of deeds. And so in this conversation, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says that the best deeds are three. We're going to talk about just one of them. Imam al-Baqir says one of the best deeds of these three is praising Allah in all conditions. Dear friends, truly, this is one of the best deeds. And when Imam al-Baqir, this divinely appointed Imam, says that this is the best deed, it means that it is the best deed which is loved by Allah. And now, it's very easy to praise Allah when our financial situation is good, when our health is good, you know, when we live in a good, safe environment, when everything is going our way. It is really easy to praise Allah, to thank Allah, to be humble in front of Allah. But in certain aspects, it gets harder to praise Allah and thank Allah and be humble in front of Allah when things aren't going our way, when we are financially unstable, when our health seems to deteriorate, when we're having family issues and family problems. In these conditions, to remain patient, to remain steadfast, to be firm in our faith and belief and trust in Allah really becomes difficult. And this is how and why we understand that one of the best traits, as Imam al-Baqir has said, is to praise Allah in all conditions, whether good or bad. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
So this is the first time in the history of Islam that, you know, coins are being minted by Muslims themselves. And this is done under the guidance of our fifth Imam. The year where dirham, the silver coin, was minted is the sixth year of the Hijrah, corresponding to 696 of the common calendar. And a year after that, the gold coins were minted in that way. And later on, they also had fils, which is copper coins. And this is something mentioned by even Sunni historians. And not only that, the importance of this event and the impact that it had on the economic life of the Muslim society has been acknowledged even by the non-Muslim scholars of the past as well as the present time. One of the contemporary Western scholars of the Islamic history by the name of Lapidus, he has a book called A History of Islamic People, and it's one of the very well written book on the early history of Muslim people. Although he's a non-Muslim, but he's very sympathetic to the cause. And there, when he talks about this minting of the coins for the first time in the Muslim empire, these are his words. He says, the new Arab coins did away with the Christian and Zoroastrian symbolism and introduced gold and silver coins with Arabic script to symbolize the sovereignty of the state and its independence from and equality with, if not superiority, to the previous empires. Another historian of our own time, who is Arab but from the Christian background, from Lebanon, Albert Hourani, in his book A History of the Arab People, he also says, the first clear assertion of the permanence and distinctiveness of the new order came in 690s, in the reign of the Caliph Abdul Malik, at the same time as Arabic was introduced for purpose of administration, a new style of coinage was brought in. And this was significant since coins are symbols of power and identity. Although he doesn't mention that the person who introduced this to Abdul Malik bin Marwan was the Shi'i Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salatu wasalam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.